For this Thursday, July 30th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your headlines. A final farewell to Congressman John Lewis, who died earlier this month after battling pancreatic cancer. We will have highlights from inside one of the most historic churches in our country. Also today, a new report by the Department of Homeland Security identifying 98 emerging COVID-19 hotspots in 30 states. There is, though, some encouraging news on a vaccine. Johnson & Johnson today reporting some early successes in its research, moving to a new round of clinical trials in humans. The Senate today offering a moment of silence for the more than 150,000 Americans who have died from coronavirus. And new Commerce Department numbers showing a record decline in the U.S. economy as another 1.4 million Americans filing claims for unemployment this last week, marking the 19th week in a row that the jobless numbers exceeded 1 million. The president questioning whether the November election should be delayed. Quick reaction from Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill. The story shaping Washington today. It's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin in Atlanta. Today's final farewell to a congressman, a civil rights leader, and former President Barack Obama's words, the founding father of America's better future. Inside the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church, a written statement by former President Jimmy Carter and tributes by three other former presidents, George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, joining President Obama in praising John Lewis and highlighting a lifetime of achievements, in his words, to make the U.S. a more perfect union. It was a day of tributes, remembrances, an occasional laugh, and lots of music.
Born in Troy, Alabama.
Today's funeral at the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, capping off a week of ceremonies and celebrations for the life and legacy of John Lewis. He was honored in his birthplace of Alabama, here in Washington at the U.S. Capitol, and ceremonies at the Georgia State Capitol. Today, President Barack Obama said John Lewis was the most famous disciple of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King in their quest for civil rights.
Like John, we've got to fight even harder for the most powerful tool that we have, which is the right to vote. The Voting Rights Act is one of the crowning achievements of our democracy. That's why John crossed that bridge. That's why he spilled his blood. And by the way, it was the result of Democratic and Republican efforts. President Bush, who spoke here earlier, and his father, signed its renewal when they were in office. President Clinton didn't have to because it was the law when he arrived, so instead he made a law to make it easier for people to register to vote. But once the Supreme Court weakened the Voting Rights Act, some state legislators unleashed a flood of laws designed specifically to make voting harder. Especially, by the way, state legislators where there's a lot of minority turnout and population growth. That's not necessarily a mystery or an accident. It was an attack on what John fought for. It was an attack on our democratic freedoms. And we should treat it as such. If politicians want to honor John, and I'm so grateful for the legacy and work of all the congressional leaders who are here, but there's a better way than a statement calling him a hero. You want to honor John? Let's honor him by revitalizing the law that he was willing to die for. Right. And by the way, naming it the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, that is a fine tribute. But John wouldn't want us to stop there, just trying to get back to where we already were. Once we pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, we should keep marching to make it even better by making sure every American is automatically registered to vote, including former inmates who've earned their second chance. By adding polling places and expanding early voting and making Election Day a national holiday, so if you are somebody who's working in a factory or you're a single mom who's got to go to her job and doesn't get time off, you can still cast your ballot.
From the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, when Barack Obama was sworn in, Congressman John Lewis on the west front of the U.S. Capitol asking the 44th president to sign the program. The first African-American president wrote the following, quote, "Because of you, John." Also paying tribute, former President George W. Bush.
There's a story in the old scriptures that meant a lot to John. In the Hebrew Bible, the Lord is looking for a prophet. Whom shall I send, God wonders, and who will go for us? Isaiah answers, here am I, send me. John Lewis heard that call a long time ago in segregated Alabama, and he took up the work of the Lord through all his days. His lesson for us is that we must all keep ourselves open to the hearing the call of love, the call of service, and the call to sacrifice for others. Listen, John and I had our disagreements, of course. But in the America John Lewis fought for, and the America I believe in, differences of opinion are inevitable elements and evidence of democracy in action. We, the people, including congressmen and presidents, can have differing views on how to perfect our union while sharing the conviction that our nation, however flawed, is at heart a good and noble one. We live in a better and nobler country today because of John Lewis and his abiding faith in the power of God, in the power of democracy, and in the power of love to lift us all to a higher ground. The story that began in Troy isn't ending here today, nor is the work. John Lewis lives forever in his father's house, and he will live forever in the hearts of Americans who act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with their God. May the flights of angels see John Lewis to his rest, and may God bless the country he loved.
That with former President George W. Bush. In an essay that he wrote shortly before his death, John Lewis left us with these words in today's New York Times with the direction that it be published on the day of his funeral. Quote, "While my time here has now come to an end, I want you to know that in the last days and hours of my life, you inspired me. You filled me with hope about the next chapter of the great American story when you used your power to make a difference in our society. Ordinary people with extraordinary vision can redeem the soul of America by getting in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble." John Lewis went on to write, "Voting and participating in the democratic process are key. The vote," he said, "is the most powerful nonviolent change agent you have in a democratic society. You must use it," he said, "because it is not guaranteed you can lose it." And then John Lewis said, quote, "Though I may not be with you, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe. Now it is your turn to let freedom ring. When historians pick up their pens to write the story of the 21st century, let them say that it was your generation who laid down the heavy burdens of hate at last, and that peace finally triumphed over violence, aggression, and war. So I say to you, walk with the wind, brothers and sisters, and let the spirit of peace and the power of everlasting love be your guide. The words of John Lewis in today's New York Times, available at nytimes.com. Also paying tribute, former President Bill Clinton, among those reflecting on his life today.
Someone asked me that night, because I had many friends in Atlanta, and I said, if I could just do one thing, if God came to me tonight and said, okay, your time's up, you got to go home, and I'm not a genie, I'm not giving you three wishes. One thing, what would it be? I said, I would infect every American with whatever it was that John Lewis got as a four-year-old kid and took through a lifetime to keep moving and keep moving in the right direction and keep bringing other people to move and to do it without hatred in his heart, with a song, to be able to sing and dance. As John's brother Freddie said in Troy, keep moving to the ballot box, even if it's a mailbox. And keep moving to the beloved community. John Lewis was many things, but he was a man, a friend in sunshine and storm, a friend who would walk the stony roads that he asked you to walk, that would brave the chastening rods he asked you to be whipped by, always keeping his eyes on the prize, always believing none of us will be free until all of us are equal. I just loved him. I always will. And I'm so grateful that he stayed true to form. He's gone up yonder and left us with marching orders. I suggest, since he's close enough to God to keep his eye on the sparrow and us, we salute, suit up, and march on.
That's from former President Bill Clinton. John Lewis, often called the conscience of the House of Representatives. He and Nancy Pelosi entered Congress the same time, spending more than three decades in the House. And today, Speaker Pelosi reflecting on the last time she saw her friend and colleague on July 4th here in Washington, D.C.
Over the 4th of July weekend, I had the privilege of visiting with John, and I brought him this flag pin that I wear, one just like it. Why I did so on that 4th of July weekend was because it is engraved with something that says, one country, one destiny. Now, wasn't that what John Lewis was all about? One country, one destiny. I mention it because this was sewn into, embroidered into the lining of Abraham Lincoln's coat that he had on the night he left us. I think he had the coat on all the time, but also that night. And John Lewis and Abraham Lincoln had so much in common. We got to know him first and foremost in front of the Lincoln Memorial when he made that beautiful, beautiful speech. John, Land State, under the rotunda, in the rotunda of the Capitol, under the dome of the Capitol, on a catafalque, a platform that was made in 1865 to hold the casket of Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln, John Lewis. John Lewis. So they had lots of connections. And by the way, just incidentally, they were both wonderful and spiritual and saintly, but they were both very good politicians. Think of John Lewis that way. You who know him know that. He always was about a more perfect union. And he was always about young people That's why, Mr. President, that article you referenced in the New York Times today, his message that would be delivered at this time as he left us, was about young people. He said to them, together you can redeem the world. Together, always perfect union, together, one nation, one destiny. And he says in the article, answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe in. Wasn't that just like John?
That from the Speaker of the House and longtime friend of John Lewis, Nancy Pelosi. His final resting place tonight, the historic Southview Cemetery in Atlanta. By the way, the full ceremony, which we aired live on the C-SPAN networks, it's available tonight on our website at cspan.org. And so while Democratic leaders in Atlanta for today's funeral services for John Lewis, the political negotiations continued on Capitol Hill over a coronavirus relief bill. But on Fox News this morning, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham saying that half of his GOP colleagues are going to vote no on any additional aid. Earlier this week, the Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell unveiled what he is calling the HEALS Act, for health care, economic assistance, liability protection, and schools act. The price tag, $1 trillion. Democrats claim it falls far short of what is needed in this pandemic. More from the Senate floor.
But there's a fact of life here in the United States Senate. It takes 60 votes to legislate, so the American people cannot get any of the additional relief that Republicans want to give them unless Democrats at least come to the table. Either our Democratic colleagues come to the table or the American people won't get the help they need. That's why I said this week would come down to one key question. Will the country get the Democrats who showed up back in March to pass the Bipartisan CARES Act, or will the country get the Democrats who showed up in June to block police reform and keep that issue alive through November? Unfortunately, 3 days in, it hasn't been a close call. The Speaker of the House and the Democratic leader refuse to let anyone else speak on their side. I understand the Democratic leader is actually forbidden his own Democratic ranking members from talking and negotiating with their Republican counterparts who are spearheading the different components. So you see, Madam President, bipartisan member-level discussions might actually generate some progress. And progress does not appear to be something the leaders on the other side want. On Monday, the Speaker of the House claimed she could not wait to start negotiations. But then on Tuesday, she said her discussion with the administration, quote, isn't a negotiation. And then the Speaker said the appropriate thing for the Senate to do is pass a bill and then we can negotiate with them. Meanwhile, the Democratic leader is over here making sure that cannot happen. This is quite the partnership, Madam President. The House Speaker moves the goalposts while the Democratic leader hides the football. They won't engage when the administration tries to discuss our comprehensive plan. They won't engage when the administration floats a narrower proposal. They basically won't engage, period. The Speaker and the Democratic leader are playing rope-a-dope with the health, welfare, and livelihoods of American families.
And so the negotiations continue, the House and Senate in session through next week as they try to work out some sort of an agreement. Now to the U.S. economy. The Commerce Department saying that the country's GDP, which is a broad measure of goods and services produced, fell 9.5% for the second quarter. The department announcing that the key point in what it calls the annualized rate, quote, real GDP, gross domestic product, decreasing at an annual rate of 32.9% in the second quarter of 2020. Now, keep in mind, that number represents one-third loss in the U.S. economy. And the New York Times is writing the following, the only possible comparison in modern American history came during the Great Depression and the demobilization after World War II, both of which occurred before the advent of modern economic statistics. And so with that news at the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow took a big hit, dropping 225 points. The S&P was off by 12. The Nasdaq, though, gained nearly 45 points, in part because of revenue gains for Facebook. And news tonight on Herman Cain, the former Republican presidential candidate and former CEO of Godfather's Pizza Chain. He has died as a result of complications from coronavirus. Cain had been ill with the virus for several weeks. He was hospitalized less than 2 weeks after attending President Trump's campaign rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma last month. He had been the co-chair of Black Voices for Donald Trump. Vice President Mike Pence calling Herman Cain an indispensable voice for the conservative movement who will be deeply missed. In addition to seeking the GOP presidential nomination, he ran for the Senate from Georgia, losing to Congressman Johnny Isaacson in 2004. Herman Cain was 74 years old. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this Thursday, July 30th. Here are some of your other headlines. D.C. public schools following the lead in Maryland and Virginia today announcing that students will begin the school year with virtual classes only. There will not be any in-person teaching at the start of this academic year. And the NBA resuming its season tonight as basketball players learning to live within the bubble, adapting to strict new guidelines, playing inside the ESPN Sports Complex at Disney World in Florida. And what some call a D.C. institution, the Washington Post is reporting that DuPont Circle's Kramer Books and Afterwards Cafe will stay in its current location for at least 3 more years. Earlier, the owner had announced his intent to move the store. Now, that is not the case. Details at WashingtonPost.com. Well, the president today is suggesting that November's general election should be postponed, citing his claims of widespread mail-in voter fraud amid the coronavirus pandemic. On Twitter, he wrote the following: "With universal mail-in voting, not absentee voting, which is good, 2020 will be the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history." He said it will be a great embarrassment to the USA, delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote. With 3 question marks. It was a tweet that sparked a lot of questions today on Capitol Hill. Here is House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy.
I understand the president's concern about mail-in voting, which is different than absentee voting. But never in the history of the federal elections have we ever not held an election, and we should go forward with our election. But we should have absentee voting, but this mass just mailing out ballots without having any checks and balances, without people requesting, really brings concern in there. But no way should we ever not hold our election on the day that we have it. Yes, sir.
Do you worry that the president, by criticizing mail-in voting, could have the effect of hurting Republican chances in the polls? You guys had an election, in a special election in California, where you won. Mail-in voting predominantly happened in that race. Should the president be raising questions the way he is and questioning the integrity of the election?
Well, I think the concern that people should have is the difference between absentee voting and what people have changed to try to do mail-in voting. You want to make sure your elections are honest and safe and secure. And in doing so, yes, in California, we have absentee voting, where people actually register, check a box, and get an absentee. And what happens when you vote by absentee, you actually sign it. And when it goes into the election office, and you can trace it, because you want to make sure your vote counts, they'll look at your signature to see if it's the same as the one that you signed for voter registration. I do believe people need to be registered to vote. And in doing so, then you know that election is safe. I have watched time and again that if you just mass mail ballots out, people have moved, voter rolls are not updated, and that's where you have real problems in elections. It's been stated, it's been shown, we've watched people hold elections up. That's what the president's talking about. He's not talking about absentee voting. He wants all Republicans, when they get their absentee vote, to put it in as soon as possible and follow it, when many states allow you to, online to make sure your vote counts. If for some reason your vote didn't count, go to the polls on Election Day. Again, the president wants all Republicans to vote absentee, putting your ballot in if you get it. But this mask creates a fraud in the process, and I understand the president's concern with that.
That from the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy of California, and the Senate GOP leader was also asked about the president's tweet earlier today. Here is Mitch McConnell. He was interviewed by WNKY-TV in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Before we talk about the coronavirus and the HEALS Act, I have to ask you about the big headline coming out of the president's Twitter feed this morning, floating the idea of moving the election date due to concerns he has over mail-in ballots. In this nation's history, that has never happened before. It would take an act of Congress. So I have to ask you, is that something you would ever consider?
Well, never in the history of the country, through wars, depressions, and the Civil War, have we ever not had a federally scheduled election on time. And we'll find a way to do that again this November 3rd.
So just to be clear, you are saying November 3rd set in stone.
That's right. We'll cope with whatever the situation is and have the election on November 3rd as already scheduled.
That from the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell with a Bowling Green, Kentucky TV station. And at today's Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, this question to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo from Virginia's Democratic Senator Tim Kaine.
And then this morning, the president is suggesting that the presidential election should be delayed. And I sort of want to start there. This is not something that either you or I were prepared to talk about today because I think it happened in the middle of the hearing. The president sent out a tweet that said, quote, delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote, question mark. Not saying it will happen, but raising a question. Can a president delay the November presidential election, Mr. Secretary?
Senator, I'm not going to enter a legal judgment on that on the fly this morning.
Mr. Secretary, you are an honors graduate of West Point. You are a graduate of the Harvard Law School. You were on the Harvard Law Review. I was at Harvard Law School, and I went to a lot of Red Sox games. I went on the Harvard Law Review.
You are very kind of you. Thank you.
You are one of the most highly trained and accomplished lawyers who are part of this administration. Can a president delay a presidential election?
Senator, in the end, the Department of Justice, others will make that legal determination. We all should want, I know you do too, Senator Kaine, want to make sure we have an election that everyone is confident in. That's not only for
you. Are you
validated.
Indifferent to the date of the election?
It should happen lawfully.
Right.
Yeah.
It should happen lawfully.
Yeah.
So for the record, because you may not want to comment on it, but I do think it's important. A president cannot delay an election. The date of the election is established by Congress. It was established in 1845. There is no ability for a president to delay an election. And I don't think it's that hard a question or one that should lead to any equivocation by somebody who's fourth in line of succession to be president of the United States. So let me ask another question.
That from earlier today, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and joining us on the phone is Todd Ruger. He is legal affairs writer for CQ Roll Call. And as you point out in your story, the president does not even have the authority to change the election. So what can you tell us?
Right. The Constitution explicitly gives Congress the power to set the date of the election. Congress did that in a federal law the Tuesday after the first Monday in November. And the reason is that the founding fathers didn't want presidents to be able to control when the country voted on them to stay in office. Congress hasn't relinquished that power to the president. The president has like a number of emergency powers through a bunch of different statutes, but none of them would allow him to delay a presidential election by himself. And not even for public health reasons. That public health power really rests with states and governors. And so if you look at what has happened so far with the COVID-19 pandemic, the Trump administration has offered guidance, but it's been governors or other state officials who have put public health measures in place.
And of course, we have had elections through a civil war, through two world wars. But even if the November 3rd election were to be delayed, what does that mean for President Trump?
Right. So, in order to move this, Congress could move the date if there's a reason or an emergency, but that doesn't appear likely today because of reaction on the Hill. And states can move the election because, you know, there might be an unexpected emergency, think like major hurricane making landfall in the U.S. on election day. Courts have the ability to delay it just a little bit in case there might be constitutional violations, but they don't do that very much. So what you get at the end is, at most, this would delay the election a few weeks if it was moved, because The Constitution has a requirement that the president's term ends at noon on January 20th. And so this year it would be 2021. So at that point, Trump would have to leave office. If there's no election, he would not be able to stay in office unless he tried to override the Constitution. But this end of the term on January 20th is a very clear and direct command in the text of the text of the Constitution.
And finally, why this tweet? Why today? And what kind of reaction did it get here in Washington?
Well, I wish I could get behind Trump's thinking on a lot of his tweets, but one of the things that's interesting about it is it has three question marks behind it. He said, delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote, three question marks. So he was kind of throwing that out there. It came about at the same time that there was bad economic numbers that were released and a lot of other things happening out there that the administration isn't happy about. And so it could just be seen as a distraction. But, you know, the fact that Attorney General Bill Barr was at the House Judiciary Committee this week and was asked about whether a president could override the law that sets the election date. And he said, I've never been asked the question before. And he told them, I've never looked into it. So he wasn't ruling it out. He just said he had never looked at it. So we don't know exactly how serious Trump or the Trump administration is when it comes to finding some way to move the election. But again, you know, why he tweeted this exactly, who knows? But it certainly got everybody talking. And on the Hill, most of the reaction was, this is not going to happen. We are not going to move it. That came from, you know, of course, Democrats who want to have the election, but also Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican, and Kevin McCarthy, the top Republican in the House. So you pretty much have Congress speaking on one voice with this, that they're not going to move it, and they have the power, and they're the ones with the power to do it.
The full story at rollcall.com. Todd Ruger, he covers legal affairs. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Also today here in Washington, during an often contentious Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says he has warned Russian officials about the threats that country poses to American and U.S. interest in various parts of the world. And in particular, Mike Pompeo was pressed about reports of Russia paying bounties to the Taliban fighters to kill American troops in Afghanistan. Here's New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez. He is the ranking Democrat on that committee.
Have you raised concerns with Russia and its Foreign Minister Lavrov with respect to Russia reportedly placing bounties on the heads of service members in Afghanistan?
Well, I want to be very careful about what's public record and what's intelligence-based, but yes, I can assure you and the American people that each time I've spoken with Foreign Minister Lavrov, I've raised all of the issues that put any American interest at risk, whether it's our soldiers on the ground in Syria, soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan, the activities that are taking place in Libya, the actions in Ukraine, each and every one of these that potentially threaten American interests are things that I raised in my conversations with Foreign Minister Lavrov, and I speak with him with some frequency.
I appreciate that answer. I ask you specifically, have you raised, for instance, this is in the public sphere, I'm not talking about classified
materials. It's not classified, Senator.
Have you raised, there are public reports, very well documented, that the Russians were supposedly paying bounties to kill our service members. Have you raised that issue with Foreign Minister Lavrov?
Senator, I'm going to be more careful than you're being with respect to the intelligence. I'm going to tell you that, make no mistake about it, the proper people have been aware of every single threat to our soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan, whether that was General Miller or my team at the embassy there in Kabul. Anytime there was a tactical threat on the lives or the health or the safety and security or our assets in place, we have raised this with our Russian counterparts, not only at my level, but Ambassador Sullivan and every one of our team that interacts with the Russians. We've made very clear our expectations.
Let me turn
to threaten us in Afghanistan.
That from this morning's Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, Secretary of State Pompeo also defending the president's decision to pull an estimated 12,000 U.S. troops out of Germany, saying that those forces will be moved to other parts of Europe, including Italy and Belgium. But Utah's Republican Senator Mitt Romney saying senior German officials considering the withdrawal, quote, an insult to Germany. And the issue of Steve Linnick came up. He, of course, the former State Department Inspector General. He was fired in May, reportedly investigating arms sales to Saudi Arabia, as well as allegations that the Secretary of State had ordered a staffer to handle personal errands. Here is Senator Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin. He's the committee chair.
There were 126 leaks having to do with national security in the first 125 days of this administration. That needs to be investigated. And I'm not, if you could describe the leaks that you were concerned about and exactly how Inspector General Linnick didn't handle that the way you thought it should be handled.
Sure. So thank you, Senator Johnson. Let me just say I value Inspectors General as well. I had a great relationship with the Inspector General at the CAA when I was there. He did his job. He took care of the team. He was critical of the agency when we got it wrong. I know what a good IG can do. Inspector General Linnick wasn't that. The incident you're referring to is that we had a very sensitive Inspector General report. When the final draft was prepared, it leaked. The Politico reporter, I think, said it came from two people close to the investigation. At that point, it was basically the IG's office and a couple of others that actually knew about it in the full report, which had a real impact on senior State Department officials' lives. When we confronted the Inspector General, he was defensive. We then asked him to undertake a process. He ignored that request to inspect, to have a separate IG come and investigate. It's pretty complicated, but suffice it to say, he didn't comply with the instructions about how we felt that leak needed to be investigated so that we could have an independent investigator do it, and then he wasn't candid about that process either. He didn't act with integrity throughout that process in a way that inspector generals have to be counted on to behave.
That from Secretary Pompeo at today's Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing. Now to campaign 2020, a new poll out today from Franklin and Marshall College showing that former Vice President Joe Biden is up 9 percentage points in Pennsylvania, a state President Trump won in 2016. Biden also leading the president in the key state of Florida with a Mason-Dixon poll showing him up by 4 points. That, though, is within the margin of error. That from the WJXT-TV poll in Jacksonville, Florida. And the campaign hotline saying that the Biden campaign is doubling down on ads in Ohio. This new spot now airing in the Youngstown and Cleveland markets beginning today.
Scranton is a long way from Wall Street. You won't find skyscrapers or big city bankers. Just hardworking people that make this country work. That's where Joe Biden's story starts. In working class neighborhoods where you could make a good living and pass on a better life to your kids. That's why Joe Biden went into public service to begin with, to make a difference for working families. Donald Trump, he ran for president for himself and for his friends on Wall Street. For Donald Trump, it's about those at the top. For Joe Biden, it's about the backbone of this nation, working families. This crisis has revealed that we must do more for workers and small businesses, not the wealthy. And Joe Biden is the one to do it. To build back better.
I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
Meanwhile, the Trump campaign is currently not running television or radio ads in another key state, Michigan, as well as its super PAC, which has also been in the dark for most of July. It is an indication, possibly, that the key Midwestern battleground state is beginning to fall out of reach for the Trump campaign, noting that it stopped running ads last week while it continues to advertise in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. That, according to the ad tracking firm Medium Buying. McClatchy News pointing out that the president has not led in a single public poll in Michigan all year. The campaign, though, is still on the air in other key states with this new ad.
He spent decades building the system, destroying millions of lives. Now, he must confront his past and prove he has what it takes to rise to this moment.
You know, the rapidly rising
That new ad from the Trump campaign. And finally, the Lincoln Project, a group of Republicans opposed to the president, with this new spot.
These are the memories COVID took from us. A child's birthday. Time spent with friends. A first kiss. Or the big day. A homecoming game on a cool fall evening. The first day of college. Or a proud graduation. Dreams of starting a business and building a legacy. Lifting our hearts in prayer and sharing our faith in God together. The blessing of a peaceful passing of an elderly parent surrounded by family. COVID has robbed America of so much. None of this had to happen. We have suffered needlessly because Trump is a fool, a liar, and a failure. Most countries stopped it. Trump refused. It's Trump's virus now. And before it's over, a million of us could die. What we've lost reminds us of the stakes this November. It truly is a choice, America or Trump. The Lincoln Project is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And this note, C-SPAN is your primary source for campaign 2020, including the upcoming conventions. It will take place in mid-August for the Democrats and late August for Charlotte, North Carolina. Live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the proceedings as they unfold. And finally, the biggest, most sophisticated Mars rover project ever built. It's a car-sized vehicle loaded with cameras and microphones and lasers. It blasted off today as part of an ambitious long-range project to bring the first Martian rock samples back to Earth. They'll then be analyzed for evidence of whether there's any ancient life on the planet. NASA's Perseverance rode on Atlas V, and this NASA-produced video chronicles how the launch unfolded as well as the mission ahead.
The Perseverance rover headed to Mars, ready to ride a column of fire and smoke on its way to the red planet.
Liftoff. As the countdown to Mars continues, the perseverance of humanity launching the next generation of robotic explorers to the red planet.
And Atlas TU has gone to closed loop control.
Standing by for SRB burnout shortly.
And we have successful separation of Mars 2020 with the Perseverance rover.
We now have an acquisition of signals, and the years of blood, sweat, and tears from every person who worked on this mission is now realized as Perseverance makes its way to Mars.
That NASA-produced video and the launch today from Cape Canaveral. By the way, China and the United Arab Emirates got a head start last week, but all three missions should reach their destination in February of next year, a journey of 7 months and 300 million miles. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you download your favorite podcast. Thanks for joining us for this Thursday. Enjoy the rest of your evening.